Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, October 16th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Jedediah Smith Redwood State Park is having construction to replace undersized culverts on Howland Hill Road. Endangered species protections sought for two Pacific Northwest fish. Eureka OK's vacational rental, the cannabis dispensary. Stay tuned. These stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
Howland Hill Road, located within the Jedediah Smith Redwood State Park, will be under construction for the next week. The first portion of the project started yesterday on October 15th and is expected to be finished today. The second portion of the project will begin on Tuesday, October 21st, 2025. According to Shalana Da Silva, the deputy district superintendent, explained what the next week will look like and what people should expect when going through the state park.
The work that will begin on the 21st will have a partial closure of Howland Hill Road. It'll be closed from the east gate to just before the Mill Creek trailhead. People should be able to access the Grove of Titans and the Mill Creek trailhead area there with the parking and the restrooms. And people should be able to access Boy Scout Trail from the west end of the road during the closure. I want to just point out that for this second portion of the work, Doubt Grove will not be accessible from the east or the west.
The construction is in response to underside culverts that need to be replaced in preparation for the rain season. Not only is this project to help public safety, but also important for the environment as well.
The culverts were undersized, and last winter they were beginning to fail. And so we want to replace them with more appropriately sized culverts and make sure that any deformation of the road is addressed. We don't want the road to fail during storms, during wet weather. Mill Creek is a salmonid bearing stream, as you know. So this is really, it's an aquatic habitat protection related project, and it's also a public access and safety project as well.
This project was initially planned as a joint project between the National and State Park Services. Due to the government shutdown, the State Park Services had to take over the project without the help of the National Park Services.
Redwood National and State Parks is a partnership. The National Park Service was going to be undertaking these culvert repairs, but with the federal shutdown, we wanted to make sure as a partnership that the public resources and access to these forests are maintained. So we thought it was really important to continue the work while we have dry weather. So State Parks is just doing our best to kind of address this situation on the fly, given the federal shutdown.
Due to the shutdown, there's a lot up in the air in regard to the government-funded environmental projects. The State Park Service is taking on a lot of responsibilities while the government is shut down, but is trying to keep the national parks still accessible to the public.
We don't anticipate taking on any major facilities and maintenance projects within the partnership that were on the NPS work list other than this one. That said, as a partnership, we really try to make sure that the public can continue to access as much of Redwood National and State Parks as possible through the shutdown. So while Redwood National Park is officially shut down, the parks are still accessible, and California State Park staff, as well as Redwood Parks Conservancy staff, are helping to make sure that visitor centers are open. So for example, Hayuchi Visitor Center, which is typically run by National Park Service staff, is currently open with State Park staff and Redwood Parks Conservancy staff. So that's one example of how we're, you know, trying to maintain accessibility to the Redwoods through the federal government shutdown.
For updates on the road closures, go to the park's website, www.parks.ca.gov/Jedediah Smith Redwoods, for up-to-date information. Due to the government shutdown, there are more questions than answers when it comes to national parks. Thankfully, we have state agencies like the California Department of Parks and Recreation taking care of the national parks while the national park workers are unable to work during the shutdown. The Center for Biological Diversity is petitioning for the protection of the Umpqua, Chub, and the Northern Roach as freshwater habitats decline. Nat Cardos reports.
Today, the Center for Biological Diversity petitioned the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to protect two declining fish species from southern Oregon and northeastern California under the Endangered Species Act, ESA. These fish, the Umpqua Chub and the Northern Roach, have been seeing populations drop off due to declining freshwater habitats. KMON News spoke to Jeff Miller, Senior Conservation Advocate for the Center of Biological Diversity, for more information on the fish.
So these are two Pacific Northwest freshwater fish species. I call them, they're in the charismatic minnow gang. They're both minnows. The Umpqua chub is found only within the Umpqua River Basin in southwestern Oregon. And then the northern roach is only in the Pitt River and some tributaries of Goose Lakes. That's in very northeastern California and southern Oregon. They're both pretty restricted in range. And these freshwater fish species are, of course, being hit pretty hard by the extinction crisis. Like one in three freshwater fish species globally is facing extinction. So these are just some of our freshwater fish species are declining because of kind of the same impacts that are, you know, harming salmon and other stream fish.
The Umpqua chub was believed to be wiped out in North Umpqua River, though in 2019, some of these chubs were documented for the first time in 93 years in a short stream reach of the North Umpqua. Some of the factors driving these fish populations' decline are stream channelization and drainage of wetlands, pollution, changing stream conditions, as well as others. Another threat to specifically the Umpqua chub has been invasive, non-native smallmouth bass. Here's Miller with more on the threats these fish face.
The decline of the Umpqua chub has really correlated, the timing is kind of, you know, correlates with the increase in non-native smallmouth bass. So this is an invasive, highly predatory species that can also compete with native fish species for food and also eat them. So the expansion of smallmouth bass throughout the Umpqua River drainage kind of corresponds almost exactly with the decline of the Umpqua chub. But then it's also threatened by, like I said, a lot of the same things that are harming our salmon populations, you know, habitat loss because of stream channelization and drainage of wetlands. It also is affected by fish passage barriers where it can't move around in streams, pollution, and then, of course, changing stream conditions because of climate change. And then the northern roach is somewhat similar. It's habitat loss. The northern roach is having a lot of habitat impacts from agriculture, from livestock grazing, from logging, from roads, but then again, also climate change and non-native invasive predatory fishes, again, largemouth bass and some other fish such as green sunfish and bluegill.
The ESA so far has been conservationists' best tool for preventing extinction, though this current administration's proposed federal cuts and attacks on laws like this one in the Clean Water Act, it may be more difficult to get these fish on the endangered species list.
Well, we're in a whole new era now. The Endangered Species Act has been our most effective tool for preventing extinction and actually recovering species that are starting to disappear. It has a 99% success rate. Most of the species that get on the list start moving towards recovery. It can take a long time to recover species. But yeah, we're now under the Trump administration and the Republicans. We're in an era where, of course, all of our environmental laws and protections are being either eliminated or just hollowed out. And Endangered Species Act, Trump administration has proposed removing pretty much the definition of harm to endangered species and making it impossible to protect endangered species from any harm that isn't deliberate, you know, going out and shooting them or fearing them. So any habitat destruction would no longer be considered harm to endangered species, which is completely nonsensical because no species can survive without their intact habitat. So we're kind of in a situation where, and obviously the budget cut, the attempts to fire federal workers, the Trump administration is starving the budget of many agencies, including Fish and Wildlife Service, and has installed people hostile to the mission of protecting endangered species. So, you know, it's kind of an uphill battle right now, and certainly no endangered species protections are going to move forward without litigation, which fortunately is something we do. So, you know, we're putting these fish in the queue to try to get protection. We don't really expect a response from the Trump administration, and we will, you know, try to shepherd them through the process using the citizen lawsuit provision that's part of the Endangered Species Act. You know, we're also looking increasingly into state protections as well for imperiled species. So looking at whether state of California or state of Oregon could protect these fish as well.
The next step for the protection of these fish appears to be litigation. To really push for these fish to be protected by the ESA, the center may have to file a citizen suit, which is a provision included in the act.
Well, there's deadlines under the Endangered Species Act for Fish and Wildlife Service to respond. They are, you know, even under Democratic administrations, Fish and Wildlife Services has been obstructionist and hostile to protecting endangered species, all the endangered species that should be protected and that clearly warrant protection. Unfortunately, it's entirely a litigation-driven system. That's the only way we move these protections forward. So I think it'll be the same here. And unfortunately, it's about a 10 to 12 year process when a species gets petitioned to when it can get protection. That the average is 10 to 12 years. That's with aggressive litigation. It's supposed to be a 2 year process, a 1 to 2 year process. So, we're gonna push forward. We're gonna be trying to fight off the Trump attacks on the Endangered Species Act itself, and certainly advocating for increased funding for Fish and Wildlife Service for the endangered species budget. And we're facing an extinction crisis here where we could lose literally up to 1 million species, different species, in the next 50 years. And so the Endangered Species Act is the emergency triage, right? This is the emergency room. We're trying to get species attention and funding and some kind of legal protections for their habitat before they get to the point where we have to, do the kind of emergency intervention that has been done with a lot of other species.
For more information, the website is biologicaldiversity.org. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.
Permits for a vacational rental and a cannabis dispensary were taken up by the Eureka Planning Commission at its meeting this week. Daniel Mintz reports.
The interests of a part-time homeowner were weighed against concerns about neighborhood and housing availability impacts when the Eureka Planning Commission approved a Myrtletown area vacation rental permit. And the meeting also included the permitting of a new cannabis dispensary. Both were approved at the commission's October 14th meeting. The vacation rental permit allows conversion of a single-family home in the Myrtletown area on East Avenue. Public comment would portray the situation as profit-driven exploitation. Adjacent property owner Scott Willits warned of the impacts of converting homes into short-term rentals.
To be blunt, vacation rentals are lucrative for property owners, but they really only have negative impacts on the neighbors. There's a loss of community connection. Long-term residents create relationships. Neither absentee owners nor their guests have any vested interest in the neighborhood, and we'll find ourselves living next to a property that is essentially a revolving door for strangers, leading to frustration and diminished quality of life. And I recognize that these are subjective complaints, so I'd like to talk about a few objective parameters. There is a wide imbalance between housing costs and income levels throughout our state, and that's especially true right here in Eureka. As more and more properties are converted into vacation rentals, the availability of long-term rental units decreases, making it harder for families to afford to live in their own neighborhoods.
Another neighbor who lives near the project site raised traffic safety and parking issues. No off-street parking is included or required for the project. A representative for the applicant said there's a valid reason for seeking the conversion.
One of the reasons why this is being turned into a vacation rental is because the property owner is in town part-time. They come and go. They have a job that calls them to other parts of the country. When they need to go, they go. And so ideally, their house isn't sitting empty while they're away at work. We're not trying to make a killing here. This is not like a business that we're trying to do. It's just trying to prevent her house from standing empty when she's away at work.
During their discussion, commissioners showed sympathy for the residents' concerns, but noted their limited ability to deny the permit under current regulations. Asked if regulations are in the process of being updated, Development Services Director Kristen Kenyon said the city council, quote, hasn't voiced it as a priority, but a zoning code update is in the works and vacation rental standards will be added to it. A staff presentation included an estimate of vacation rentals at 1.5% of the city's housing stock. The commission unanimously approved the permit with the condition that an on-site parking space be added. Also at the meeting, the commission approved a conditional use permit for a new retail cannabis sales and cultivation business with an anachronistic name, Black Market Cannabis. It's sited on Broadway, just north of a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant and south of another vacant building. A neighbor of the site said the project will be an improvement.
To be candid with you, I'm in favor of this application. I know that the property has gone through a couple of owners and been vacant for some time. I know that my own building has had some chronic burglaries, and I'm assuming that this owner would make some substantial improvements to the lighting and security around the building, and that would benefit me as well. I am a big fan of improving this part of Broadway, and I'm glad to see someone making a private capital investment to improve this property.
Parking is an issue, however, as future improvements to Broadway could eliminate some on-street parking, and the California Department of Transportation has recommended the permit be denied. But commissioners said off-street parking could be developed on nearby properties in the future and unanimously approved the permit. Another item on the agenda, a general plan conformance review for the former Kmart site on South Broadway, wasn't taken up. The county has plans to use the site to consolidate three permitting departments, but staff said the conformance review has been withdrawn indefinitely at the county's request. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
In state news, report, clean transportation brings big benefits to California. Public News Service's Laura Hatch reports.
Clean transportation projects in California and across the country are paying off, according to a new report. The research firm Atlas Public Policy analyzed the benefits of the Biden-era Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act of 2021 and the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. The report cites California's Port of Oakland, which is updating its aging equipment and reducing air pollution with a $322 million grant through the EPA's Clean Ports Program. Matt Davis with the Port of Oakland says the money will fund zero-emissions cargo handling machinery and electric trucks for cargo deliveries.
This provides local benefits through reduction of pollutants, but it also introduces a high degree of technical modernization and reliability because some of these pieces of equipment just have a lot less moving parts, frankly, that don't require as much maintenance.
Davis says neighboring states will also benefit as the port reduces its greenhouse gas emissions. Tina Hodges with Atlas Public Policy points to the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, or NEVI, funded by the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. The report says by the end of last year, nearly 60% of the nation's busiest highway corridors had fast charging stations for electric vehicles every 50 miles or more. That's up from 38% in 2020. Hodges says it's just one example of the upsides of these investments.
We found large benefits with cleaner air, new manufacturing jobs, and transportation benefits, affordable ways to get around.
The Trump administration paused NEVI earlier this year, asking states to update and resubmit their plans for EV infrastructure by September. The report says funding for some programs is in doubt, with Congress rescinding more than $2.7 billion this year, money that has been appropriated but not yet committed to a contract. Hodges hopes lawmakers will see the value in what's happened with these dollars.
This is a key moment for Congress to decide whether they'll continue to fund these clean transportation programs or stop the momentum.
I'm Laura Hatch, California News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
In national news, federal government shutdown enters third week as Trump threatens paychecks and federal workers. KPFA's Anthony Perasso reports.
Little progress has been made to end the federal government shutdown as it enters its third week, with Republicans and Democrats digging in and each convinced their messaging is resonating with voters. The shutdown is compromising payment for federal workers, air travel, and food assistance programs. The economy will lose money from the shutdown of government-run tourist sites like parks and museums, and the uncertainty is likely to slow business investments. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson comments on the dysfunction.
No one on the Republican side is taking any pleasure in this scenario. Yes, we're always for reducing the size and scope of the government and all of that, but this is not the way to go about it. We don't shut the government down, turn off the funding streams, and then require all these cuts like this.
The federal shutdown began October 1st after Democrats rejected a short-term funding fix, demanding an extension of health care subsidies that are scheduled to expire. The Republican White House has threatened the federal workforce with layoffs as leverage to pressure Democrats. Labor unions have fought back with lawsuits to block the layoffs. Frustration among workers is growing as the shutdown drags on. Democrats are concerned about health insurance subsidies expiring at the end of the year and have made the issue central to the shutdown fight. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries says he wants to reopen the government, but to avoid a health care crisis caused by Republicans.
The only way forward is for Republicans to finally decide to sit down with Democrats, negotiate a bipartisan path forward, reopen the government, pay our hardworking federal employees, and address the health care crisis that Republicans have created that is actually devastating hardworking American taxpayers all across the country, including in rural America.
The last government shutdown during Trump's first term in 2019 stretched a record 34 days. But this time, federal employees are being used more directly as leverage in the political fight over government funding. A federal judge on Wednesday temporarily blocked President Donald Trump's administration from firing workers during the government shutdown, saying the cuts appeared to be politically motivated and were being carried out without much thought. For KPFA News, I'm Anthony Perazzo.
In National Native News, Brian Bull reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. Donations are pouring in to Bethel Search and Rescue in the wake of the catastrophic storm that hit the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta over the weekend. As KYUK's Evan Erickson reports, the building has been buzzing with volunteers and recent evacuees, some of whom have lost everything.
At the Bethel Search and Rescue building, families from villages hit hardest by Sunday's storm grab items from long tables overflowing with clothes and essential goods.
There was one I just had spoken with. He had mentioned that he can finally change his clothes.
Volunteer Caitlin Andrew says her father and other family members are still sheltering in the coastal community of Guigilingok. The storm, remnants of Typhoon Halong, nearly completely destroyed the village, and roughly 400 people sheltered at the school awaiting evacuation on Tuesday evening.
They're messaging us and letting us know what they need over there right now.
Andrew says that within an hour of opening the donation center on Monday, totes and bags from community members quickly filled up the corner of the one-story building.
That pile over there was literally almost to the ceiling until we started organizing things.
The donations include winter boots, baby formula, and basic hygiene products, shampoo, toilet paper, and tampons. Most of the items are going directly to people already evacuated to Bethel. Some are being boxed up and sent to those still sheltered in coastal villages. Volunteer Angie Walter stacks three boxes filled with clothes for a family in the Nelson Island community of Nightmute.
The bottom box is mostly boots, and there's hats and gloves, pants and tops for a boy and a girl, and I guess maybe the dad and the mom.
Volunteers say that with winter just weeks away, more cold weather gear is needed. While some communities will be able to rebuild what was lost, others face a bleak future or total uncertainty of whether their community will ever recover. Andrew, who still has family members stuck in the most affected area, says that all she and other volunteers can do is offer their support for people grappling with the concept of leaving behind their traditional homes.
Some of them don't want to because that's where they grew up and that's their home. And so I think it's just to be there for them and to make sure that they know that they have a place.
Meanwhile, outside of the building, volunteers scramble to make space for roughly 10 pallets of goods that have just arrived from Anchorage. The donations are coming in from all over, and volunteers say they're critical, with 100 people already evacuated to Bethel and hundreds more on the way. In Bethel, I'm Evan Erickson.
This past Monday, many cultural observances were held in honor of Indigenous Peoples or Native American Day, including an annual event at Alcatraz Island in Northern California's Bay Area. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that the Sunrise Gathering features prayer, dancing, and songs, despite the many closed national parks and in protest of President Trump's plans to reopen Alcatraz as a prison. Historically, a large gathering of Native people occupy the island prison from 1969 to 1971. With the exception of 2013 during another government shutdown, the annual gathering has taken place with another one held on Thanksgiving Day. The International Indian Treaty Council hosted the event. And during this week in 1891, people mourn the passing of Sarah Winnemucca, the first Native woman who published a copyrighted work in the U.S. Her book, Life Among the Paiutes, Their Wrongs and Claims, was an autobiographical work published in 1883. Her birth name was Thaukmetane, or Shellflower. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Patricia Tinkler, and thanks to our reporters, Nat Cardos, Daniel Mintz, Laura Hatch, Anthony Perrazzo, and Brian Bull. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple's Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.